Welcome everyone, glad to have you with us. I'm Henrik Palmgren and you are listening to Red Ice Radio. We are quickly approaching the 21st of December 2012 and the end of the Mayan calendar, and this would be the more known or accepted calendar conversion. But today we are going to talk about what it all means and what we potentially might be in for, together with three different guests whose work all connects in some way. We have Jay Widener, Barbara Hand-Klo, and Lawrence Joseph with us. Over the past 25 years, Lawrence has written on science, nature, politics, and business, including the books Apocalypse 2012 and Solar Cataclysm. Barbara Hand-Klo is an international lecturer, workshop teacher, and writer. Her latest book is Awakening the Planetary Mind. And then we also have Jay Widener. He is an author, filmmaker, and hermetic scholar, called by Wired Magazine an authority on the hermetic and alchemical traditions, and he continues his worldwide quest to find clues to mankind's spiritual destiny. Jay's latest film is called Kubrick's Odyssey. In the first hour, each guest presents their research concerning 2012 and the end of the Mayan calendar, and they all agree that the sun is of major concern, and they disagree on some other points. Stay with us as we get into the details. All right, welcome to this 2012 Roundtable Special. This is going to be a lot of fun. We're talking with three different researchers whose work connects, of course, in many ways. And let's bring him on one at a time and kind of get going here. Lawrence Joseph, first of all, hi and welcome to you first. We haven't had you on the program before, so thank you for coming on. Looking forward to talking more about your work today.
My pleasure.
Very good. Barbara Hand-Klo, we've had you with us many times before. Thank you for coming back, Barbara, and joining us as well.
I'm happy to be here.
And then we have finally Jay Widener, whom we also have had with us a number of times before. Welcome back, Jay. How are you?
Hey, I'm great.
Very good to talk to each and every one of you. I think we should begin with you, Lawrence, since we, again, haven't had you on previously. You've written both on the 2012 apocalypse, the solar cataclysm, two central themes, of course, to the subject that we're going to get into. Why don't you give us your assessment of the situation, I guess, as best as you can, and if you feel, I guess, the same about the subject today as when you did when you began writing about it many years ago. What do you think, Lawrence?
Well, when I first began researching the subject was in late 2004. I was not even a skeptic. I didn't care one way or another about anything having to do with 2012 or any other date particularly other than perhaps my birthday. But I was chairman of a plasma physics research company headquartered in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And one day the principal scientist, Dr. Roger Remy, came up to me and said, "The sun is making mayonnaise." I thought, "That, what does that mean?" Roger, don't bother me. But he said, in his argot of Algerian, French, Israeli, I'm not really sure what else is mixed in there, it meant that the sun is having a nervous breakdown, is in tumult, is behaving dangerously. And of course, the last thing anybody wants to do is worry about the sun. You've got enough to handle in daily life. You know, but the sun is really the greatest constant we know, greater even than God, because some people don't believe in God. So just to shut them up, I went on the European Space Agency and NASA websites and saw that the sun had been having more sunspots and storms. And they were more frequent and ferocious than history would have indicated, and that this had been going on for about 150 years, with the last 20 or 30 being particularly tempestuous. And the only thing that the astronomers could agree upon, other than this fact of extreme behavior, was that the next climax of these storms would come in late 2012 or early 2013. Well, at the time, it was thought 2012. So on impulse, I Googled 2012 one night and fell down this rabbit hole of very colorful New Age assessments of what might happen in 2012. And I kind of admired it for its decorative quality, but it wasn't something that spoke to me as a science writer until I realized that the bottom of it all was some brilliant ancient Mayan astronomy. Not astrology, but astronomy. Folks who, without a lens or a computer, much less spacecraft, charted the heavens admirably and with breathtaking accuracy. And one of the mistakes that a lot of science and science buffs make is thinking that something is ancient and is therefore not science. This is as rigorous as it could have possibly been at the time. And so my attitude is to give genius the benefit of the doubt, and this was certainly a genius discipline. So I thought 2012 is a significant date for these folks, or so says the Internet. But the Internet, you know, somebody states a quote-unquote fact, and then it gets repeated hundreds of times over. It doesn't make it true.
Yeah.
So I went down to Guatemala and spent about 10 days working with a couple of Mayan shamans, with themselves, Carlos and Gerardo Barrios, who had spent 20 years going around the former Mayan territories, talking to shamans and sages and elders to determine what the prophecies were about 2012 and everything else. And they concluded in a nutshell that December 21st, 2012, or really they don't care so much about the numerical quality of the date as winter solstice, 2012,
right. Yeah.
Would be the birth of a new era, and like any other birth, it would be accompanied by joy and blood and pain. It was the blood and pain part that caught my attention. Because joy you don't have to prepare for. You don't have to defend against. Joy you don't have to do anything. Just enjoy it. But the threat that was looming, that got me worried. And the coincidence between that prophecy and the contemporary astronomer's idea that the next solar climax would come in 2012, that's what launched me into researching this project. And I've got a good deal more to the story, but I think I'd like to hear the other folks and see how they got into it, if they wouldn't mind sharing that.
Definitely. Let's do that right away. How about you, Barbara, your backstory on this?
Well, yeah, where my background starts with the Mayan calendar is in the late 60s and early 70s. When I got to know some of the early researchers, and then actually my background goes way back before that, but it took me a while to connect the dots because I'm part Cherokee and was trained by my grandfather. And my grandfather definitely knew about the calendar because I can see that in a lot of the dates that he was working with. And so my background with this goes way, way back, and I'm one of those people out there who has been trying to figure out what on earth 2012 might mean for about maybe 35 or 40 years, kind of a concentrated practice with it. And I'm also was a publisher during 20 years of that time, and so I ended up being the publisher of some of the key people like Jose Arguelles and John Major Jenkins and Hoon Bots Men, et cetera. And so where I'm going with the calendar now is that I experienced a very, very big shift regarding the end of the calendar. In other words, I was focused on December 21st, 2012, until 2004, just about the time that Lawrence first went down into Guatemala, which is interesting. And I also started focusing on solar flares like crazy in 2003 because I almost drove off the road during an intense solar flare. And then I tried to give the car to my husband, and he couldn't drive either. And this was the X-45 solar flare that happened in, I think, November 2003.
Right.
And so I've actually, you know, experienced what these things can do to my consciousness and to my physical body. And so I've been also very focused on the sun. And the big shift for me, as Henrik knows, is that in the middle of all of my Mayan research, finally Bear & Company, the company that I used to be the editor for, published Carl Johan Kalaman. And as soon as I got into Carl Johan Kalaman's work, I had a greater resonance with the calendar because Carl is working with a model that looks at the calendar over 16.4 billion years and works with the calendar as a time acceleration factor. And I'm so much more interested in what the calendar is really saying in terms of what kind of data it covers the name about the actual date, and I don't really think there's much of a difference between October 2011 and December 21st, 2012, except for the winter solstice factor. So at this point, this year, during 2012, the whole year for me has been really miraculous in just in terms of the kind of consciousness that people seem to be able to access at this time, and I'd love to discuss that sometime during the show. And along with Lawrence, I'm also extremely concerned about what the sun is doing, and I think it's a very, very big issue. So that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Indeed, and you have a very interesting and a kind of a different entry point into the subject as well. Tell us about this, Jay.
Well, actually, I got into 2012, like you said, through kind of the back way, and it's actually a story filled with a lot of coincidence and synchronicities. But basically, I decided in 1986, after reading the book Mysteries of the Cathedrals by Fulcanelli, an enigmatic and anonymous alchemist, I read his final chapter on the cyclic cross of Henday and decided that I was going to debunk it. And so I actually went to France and made sure that the cross was really there and everything. And as I set out to debunk it, I got converted to its reality. And basically, this little cross in a town in the south of France was saying, after I correctly deciphered it using Fulcanelli's prescriptions, was saying that the sun goes through a 26,000 year cycle, where every 6,500 years or so there's a major solar flare blow off, and that this blow off is so huge that it will destroy most of the life on Earth. And it's happened before, and it'll happen again. And that this cross was placed there by a secret society that has been keeping this knowledge throughout the millennia, and that they wanted us to know about this knowledge, and they put it on the cross. So I went to, I started writing a book with Vincent Bridges about the cross at Henday, and gratefully Barbara read the book and helped me to get it published. And I'll always thank you for that, Barbara. And so the book basically, you know, deciphered the cross and says that the timing on the cross says that around this time period right now, remember this is a 400-year-old cross, that that this solar thing, the angry sun, would return. And so the and so here we are in the summer of 2012, was the worst drought in history, almost, not quite, but almost, in the United States. There's a drought in China, there's a drought in Argentina, there's a drought in Russia, there's a drought in Australia, New Zealand, and the drought in the United States is so huge that it encompasses almost every single part of the United States, except for the Northwest and the Northeast. And in particular, the trees are dying everywhere, all over the United States. And I can't tell you what's going on. I've talked to Paul LaViolette, and he says that the UV rates are skyrocketing, that you'll be out in the sun and it may only be 80 degrees, but it feels like it's 100. Huh. And that's because the UV is skyrocketing. And I say all this because on top of this research, 25 years ago, I was also told by a very high-up guy in NASA that they were very worried about the sun, that something is going on with the sun, and that it's super top secret what's going on. And he did not tell me what was going on, except that they were very, very concerned about it. And so here we are, and at the end of a cycle, and the sun is acting extremely weird. There's even speculation that, you know, it's in the very first stages of going into a red giant, which would be very disconcerting. So I don't want to scare anybody, but that's what the cyclic cross of Henday says, and it's been right so far, and so we should all take that into account.
Remarkable. We want to return to that a little bit later in Fulcanelli as well. But Lawrence, if we return to you for a moment here, do you think that the sun, the solar event so far, the sunspots, the CMEs, have been as dramatic as predicted so far. There seems to have been kind of a back and forth on this. I mean, NASA's even downplayed it, and then they pushed it forward. They said it might not actually come until later 2013 or 14. It seems to be going back and forth. So where are we, Lawrence, in this predicted outbursts of the sun right now?
Well, the climax seems likely now to occur in probably late 2012, very late through 2013. But trying to figure out the climax is government grant time. You know, people can spin their wheels a lot and charge it off to research expenses. What we really need to do is take the action to defend against the possible major storms. I mean, we had a storm in 1859 called the Carrington event that was the largest solar blast in recorded history, and that if it were to hit today, a blast of that magnitude, or even one that occurred in 1921, which is almost as large, it would knock out the electrical power grid for months or years. And that's not according to me. That's according to the National Academy of Sciences of the United States in conjunction with NASA in a landmark report called Severe Space Weather Events, issued in 2009.
Yeah.
No electricity for months or years would make Hurricane Sandy and any other cataclysmic event we've experienced seem like child's play, seem like a minor inconvenience. Because without electricity is the cornerstone of our society. Without it, not only no telecommunications, but no gasoline or little or no gasoline or water because the pumps are electric. Refrigeration, law enforcement, military security, banking, all depend on electricity. Now, why I say it's sort of less important than to try to guess when the next big one's coming than to take action is there's action to be taken. This is the message of the story. We can protect the power grid. We have the technology. We have the financial means. And it all comes down to something that's gloriously unromantic. It's basically surge suppressors can protect the grid. Same way you use a surge suppressor to protect your flat-screen TV or your computer equipment from local power surges, we can protect the power grid. The same way, you insert the surge suppressor in between the ground and the transformers, which are the vulnerable points, and deflect any incoming solar EME or electromagnetic pulse. Now, this is a very serious proposition, so serious that the United States House of Representatives in June 2010 voted unanimously to take the steps to protect the grid. And those folks won't cross the aisle to perform the Heimlich maneuver, and somehow they came together unanimously to take this action. Of course, in the Byzantine world of Washington, D.C., the Senate then scuttled its corresponding legislation, so nothing got done.
Wow.
But I wrote an opinion editorial for the New York Times urging the Senate to change their mind. I mean, big surprise that they didn't listen to me, but guess what? There's good news. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which has most of the power over the power of the electrical power grid, in October of this year issued a set of regulations requiring owners and operators of the power grid to, within 6 months, make demonstrable progress toward protecting the grid. And so this is really an amazing, amazing coming together. Now, just because regulations are issued doesn't mean that they will be followed. But nonetheless, this agency made an end run around the Congress, which was doing less than nothing, and stuck itself out there and said, you will be in violation of the law if you don't take steps to protect the power grid. And I think it's remarkable. And nobody talks about, like, when I testified, these things are... For example, I went to a 19-nation summit in Parliament in London. I mentioned very little about 2012 per se because immediately the oogie-boogie meter goes up and people don't want to listen to you.
Right.
But in point of fact, 2012 is the pivotal date in this process. It led me, and I'm sure many others, to think more deeply about the sun and what it might do if it misbehaves, or, you know, I suppose misbehaves is a value judgment that I should make, but it acts up. And it's like a grail quest. Grail quest, you search for something that you cannot necessarily obtain or may not even exist, but it leads you to a more valuable situation. And that's the way I see 2012. It's led us all to a more enlightened and also just more practical way of thinking. Even if the thumbnail version that, oh, life is going to end at 2012 or whatever, proves, God willing, and most likely false.
Even if we were to begin this process right now of the surge suppressors or protectors, will it be enough time? I mean, is this slated to occur on the winter solstice precisely, Lawrence?
No.
As we know?
No. No. I mean, the climax is supposed to go through late 2013. I don't know how much we could protect right now. I mean, it pains me to say that even if there were an all-out crash program, we could buffer the damage somewhat by choosing key nodal points around the grid and getting the technology ready and inserted, but basically we'd still suffer badly. But it might be the difference between catastrophe and apocalypse.
Barbara, if we return to you a little bit, do you think that this is part, let's assume that some of the things that Lawrence mentions here and Jay as well is true, do you think that this is a part of an effort of the greater system as a whole to bring mankind up to another level, or would this simply knock us back into the Stone Age and there would just simply be catastrophe afterwards, or is there an upside to potential things that might go on this level?
Yeah, well, this takes me to another one of my books, which I know Lawrence has read because he cited it in his 2007 book, a book called Catastrophobia.
It's
a good book. And then, fortunately, the publisher, so many things happened in I had so many ideas in Catastrophobia that ended up being proven accurate during the period from 2003. It came out in 2001, so from like 2001 to like 2009 or 10. So many of the ideas in the book ended up being proven by researchers that I was able to take the book, and I did a revision of it, and I was able to take 90% of the stuff in the old book. It would say something like, if it is true that blah, 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 then. And I was then able to go to that wonderful place of saying, according to science, we see that, and then proceed from there. So I took it and rewrote it as Awakening the Planetary Mind, which came out in 2011. And the issue with Catastrophobia and Awakening the Planetary Mind is that my grandfather taught me that our planet went through an absolutely horrific cataclysm around 11,500 to 13,000 years ago. And this cataclysm is described in all ancient records and myths. Some people talk about it as the fall of Atlantis. But my grandfather's point, coming from Cherokee records, was that science needed to wake up to the actual fact that this cataclysm 12,000 years ago, and that science needed to come forth and describe what happened to our planet. And the reason that this was important was that people, according to my grandfather, all of us, anybody who incarnates on this planet, has some form of memory of this cataclysm. Maybe it's cellular, maybe it's in the genes, maybe it's past lives, who knows where it's coming from. But the idea would be that all of us are carrying this memory of this absolutely horrendous experience that went on for thousands of years on our planet, the Younger Dryas period, and then into the actual cataclysm right after that. And the idea was that we are a multi-traumatized species unless we can recover our records. And I've been living in kind of in the middle of a miracle from like 2001 up to 2012, because I've been watching science wake up. And I've been watching wonderful researchers like Lawrence Joseph come along. And by the way, I love the way your work on Dmitriev, the Russian scientist, because I think the person right now who has some of the biggest keys regarding what's happening with the sun is the Russian scientist Dmitriev.
Yeah.
And so at this point, we're in a very interesting place based on, and remember, my research is consciousness. I'm so happy to hear that that some of the regulatory agencies might be taking some responsibility at this point, because I think it's critically important. But in my case, I'm always looking into what is happening to our species in terms of our consciousness. And I think that December 21st, 2012 is a huge kind of fulcrum of the global mind, and I personally have no doubt whatsoever that we're going to get through it. I don't personally think there's going to be any kind of big cataclysm in the next 3 or 4 weeks, although I do think we're in a period of high likelihood of severe problems in the next 10 years. But the question is, where are we at with that issue in terms of consciousness? And I think we're at a wonderful point where people are now realizing how fragile our ecosystem is. People are realizing that we're traveling on a lonely planet that's going around the sun with a whole group of other planets, that's moving through the galaxy at this point, apparently into a rather difficult section of the galaxy. And I think that the most important thing right now is that we are in the middle of a species-level awakening about our own species on this planet and our relationship to the Earth. And following Kalaman's idea of looking at the calendar over 16.4 billion years from the beginning, that would be the Mayan time for the Big Bang, I think that the calendar itself is indicating that this is our awakening time. And that's why I find it so exciting and thrilling to be alive. And I think I'm just as concerned as both of the two guys on the phone with me about what could happen during this period.
Indeed. But in your view, Barbara, there's no, I guess we could call it purpose then, to the point that the sun would just basically knock us all out, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, what I am noticing, of course, since I believe that the calendar completed itself October 28th, 2011, I've been very interested to watch as many people as possible to see how they're responding. And I have never seen such incredible creativity coming through people as I've been seeing, especially since about May or June of 2012. I'm just seeing people just saying, okay, I'm going to go for it, because who knows how long we're going to be here, and it's time to give our gift. And I think that might be part of a kind of concrescence that's going on with human consciousness.
Very good. Jay, how about Falconelli briefly here? How do you think that he was able to come to this conclusion with what he had available to him at this time? Because it's very interesting to hear as well from the others, and Barbara as well, how she brings up the precession cycle. And in your view, Jay, is the 21st of December 2012 connected to the closing point of the precession cycle?
Yes, Falconelli was no doubt a member of some elite group who know, and probably were the group that, the part of the people that built the Cross of Hende 400 years ago. And my good friend Robert Lawler, who has a book coming out, who studied, translated Schwalter de Lubitz's work and worked with the Aborigines, he's proven pretty much in his new book that there's been this society living with us, adjacent to us, for thousands of years. And they've left their markers all over the place, including the Cross of Hende and the pyramids and the Mayan calendar and a lot of other things. And the number one thing that this group wants us to know is that there's this cycle. And so I think that there's not, my own opinion is that the politicians are never going to put anything onto the electrical grid to save it, because they don't think it's important enough to spend money on. I hope they do. But I also have a radical view that maybe possibly losing all of our electricity may be actually a good thing for the human race. And because Lawler's studies of the Aborigines in Australia prove that hunter-gatherers are anything but stupid or backwards or anything. They're very advanced. The Aborigines in Australia were very advanced people, both spiritually and culturally, even though they appeared to be hunter-gatherers. So I'm not sure that technology and electricity have been all that good for us. So perhaps nature's just doing a rain check.
Lawrence?
Jay, we might have a little debate here. Do you have children?
Yes.
Okay. It's one thing not to have developed dependence on electrical infrastructure in the first place, but the horror of what could happen to innocent people, who children and elderly who are deprived of the electricity that they come dependent upon, I just don't see that as a good thing. Maybe in some long-term ultra-ethereal perspective, one could justify that, but it's unfathomable to me how one could wish for that to happen.
I don't wish for it to happen.
Can I break in with both hands?
Sure, go ahead, Barbara.
Sure.
Yeah. The reason that I adopted Kalaman's interpretation of the calendar is because he shows that we've been going through a series of time accelerations. And the ones that are easiest to understand are the 5,125-year cycle, which we're talking about today, which has to do with basically the development of priest-king cultures and state cultures on the planet. Then the next cycle, the next time acceleration, is 1755 through 2011, and that one is the development of industry. And then the next cycle is 1999 through 2011, and I'd like to go back to 1999 at some point on this show. But 1999 through 2011 is the acceleration of technology. And then during 2011, the final time acceleration was March through October. And that time acceleration had to do with the concrescence of human consciousness. We can call it unity consciousness, is one term I've heard. So I come in between because we've developed the state cultures, and we've developed industry, and we've developed technology. And we've gone through each one of those stages, and I think what's actually happening in our reality is that those structures are transforming into something else. For example, pretty strong proof of string theory arrived right after the end of the calendar in December 2011, when the Higgs boson was pretty much solidly detected. And also the tech mathematicians in Japan came up with some of the calculations for string theory. And so when I look at this issue of the power grid going down and the tremendous suffering, I also think something else is going on, in that we be in the early stages of moving into an era where our technologies are based on string theory. They've been mostly based on quantum mechanics, of course, for the last 100 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually think something else is going on here, and I'm certainly the last person in the world who can imagine what it would be, but I do have a lot of trust in the processes that seem to be moving forward.
Could we be talking about a situation here where mankind basically have to be smacked around a little bit, if I can put it that jokingly?
That's what I would say.
Yeah.
I would say that. But what's happening here is, I pretty much agree with Barbara, is that the technology is the way that the Vedic texts say is that we were once an extremely psychic species, and that through this trauma we've let our abilities atrophy. And technology, as good as it is and as much as I like it, and I do like it, is a replacement for these abilities that we have let atrophy. Phones are a replacement for the telepathic abilities that we had. And we know the study of indigenous people who have not been touched by technology, that they're highly psychic and highly intuitive and with each other and with nature. And so I think that the technology has created a wall between us and our own abilities. And I think that it has also helped us in this awakening because the internet has been one of the most incredible things that's ever happened to the human race. And right now, because of the internet, everybody on Earth is all waking up at the same time. And we're figuring out, you know, basically that there's a corrupt elite ruling and that the bankers are controlling the economy and that the military has gone insane. And but we're all waking up to these things all at the same time, and we have to thank technology for that. But I think that the technology is only a bridge to something that's going to make the human race a far more interesting species. But unfortunately, we're going to have to get kicked around a little bit. And remember that all awakenings and all enlightenments are almost generally preceded by some kind of catastrophe, whether on a personal level with a divorce or losing a best friend, or those are the things that usually lead to some kind of awakening. And so this is going to happen on a global level.
So that will be the incentive for us to head into a different direction, and although
that's
could
right.
be cruel in one sense, it might be... Well, necessary to a certain extent.
It does. It needs to happen. We've gotten lazy, and everyone is expecting that a savior is going to come save them, and no savior is coming. And we've got to get mature and realize that too is kind of a form of insanity.
Lawrence, I know that you've been talking about the paradox of progress, that we've become dependent on the progress that we've developed, and if we could have brought the steps of the previous knowledge with us, meaning if something could happen, there wouldn't be a problem if we could kind of fall back to the previous without a problem and make do with what we have available. But that's not the case right now, is it?
No, I mean, people ask me, well, if the power grid went down, what would it be like? It would be like living in pre-electric society. I said, no, it would be a lot worse than that, because a lot more difficult, because those folks know how to live without electricity. We don't. And I think the question that needs to be considered is, yes, technology has its ups and downs and merits and drawbacks, but the loss of it, the loss of electricity-based technology right now would create so much suffering that I don't give a damn about the enlightenment that would come afterwards. I respectfully disagree with Barbara and Jay on this. I mean, I don't see it. It may be an evolutionary advance, but not all evolutionary advances are good. And I will fight like hell.
In your view, Lawrence, is this only going to lead to suffering, or as could it be, as Jay and Barbara said, an upside to this, that this will be the incentive for us to look at things differently or even develop a different kind of technology?
Oh, well, it will do more than just lead to suffering, but I'm saying the suffering would be monumental. And my little stake in this game is to do what I can to prevent it from happening, I mean, you know, or to moderate it. It's like you said, do we need a little smack in the face? I think we do. There used to be a television commercial for men's aftershave where the smack the guy in the face and say, yeah, thanks, I needed that. And we do need a smack in the face. What we don't need, like, is a kick in the jaw.
Barbara? I'm not advocating, I'm not with Jay in hoping for the end of the electrical grid.
Hold it. I never said I was for it. I just suggested that maybe it isn't as horrible as we imagine.
No, I know. But I mean, I don't even think that it's... I personally don't even think that's what's going to happen, and I know you do, Lawrence. I see us moving into a transmutation into another technology that actually will probably be connected with the power of the sun. But I'd also like to say that, speaking of having children, I raised 4 children. And at this point, I'm going to be 70, and I still don't have any grandchildren. But I have my first grandchild is coming, and we know the date this baby is going to be born, because it's by cesarean. And my first grandchild is arriving December 21st, 2020.
Yeah. Congrats on that. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Nobody did anything to make that happen. And so I'm one of those people who's just the most deeply concerned. Nothing can make me happier than to realize that you, Lawrence, are working with other scientists to get them to pay attention to this. In fact, one of the reasons that I really have admired your work is that I feel like the global elite put the Al Gore hypothesis in front of the public eye so that they could just create another business and milk the planet as much as possible during a period that they consider to be an end. And meanwhile, the issue here is the sun. It always has been the sun. It always will be the sun. And unless scientists get off of global warming and carbon credits and get onto the real problem, we're never going to get anywhere with the issue.
Amen.
Could there be a... is there any option for a slow transition? Let's assume that the changes on the sun are not going to be that dramatic that we've been talking about so far, but it's going to be maybe an increasing, or we're going to get hits here and there, and we'll get, as we've gotten in the past, not a Carrington event, but maybe the one that knocked out electricity in, was it Quebec at one point, and New York another, and you know, there's been various hits. Yeah, exactly. So could that be enough incentive, Lawrence, for us to get onto the surge suppressors that you talked about? But furthermore, just to extend on that point, that still wouldn't protect people's individual gear and devices that they have if an EMP strong enough came, correct?
That's correct. We've had two wake-up calls, 1989 and the Halloween storm of 2003, which was extended into early November that Barbara was talking about. And we slept through both of them. I guess we're just talking about a matter of degree. What's sufficient pain for us to jump into action, but insufficient injury so that it doesn't preclude us from doing so? And I think as many words as we can manufacture and put out, no matter how eloquently or repetitively, it does seem like we're going to need that catastrophe, that hastened evolution that Jay was talking about, but I really hope it's limited.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right now, victims of Hurricane Sandy, a buddy of mine's been without electricity for 2.5 weeks. It's kind of cold. And the prediction from the Academy of Sciences is months or years.
Wow. Do you believe, Lawrence, that Hurricane Sandy was a direct part of the changes going on with the sun right now?
I couldn't prove it, so I won't state it.
Okay. Jay, by the way, I want to return to you if there's anything you wanted to kind of add or extend on to some of the point of what you're trying to say with the incentive here for mankind to get up on its feet and head into a different direction.
Well, you know, awareness and consciousness is exactly what's going on here, like what Barbara said. But what is expanding consciousness and what is awareness? Well, you know, it's knowing what's going on and it's being aware of what's going on, and it's making plans and to make sure that you're okay for when this thing happens. And so I think waiting for the government to do anything, especially a government as in trouble as the United States government is not, it's just not going to work. What has to happen is people have to start planning on an individual basis. I know many people who are forming intentional communities that are built around water supplies and food growing and off the grid, and I think this is an expanding movement because of the things that we're all finding about the sun and how precarious the situation is anyway. And I'm not sure that there's much that can be done to salvage the situation if this thing should happen. All I know is that if you go back into prophecy and you look at the various prophets and what they say, we're in for a bad time right now. But that bad time is the evidence of that bad time is just a symptom of the awakening. So I think that we have to understand that, and that, believe me, I've been around this game for a long time, and I know people are much more aware and much more hip to the criminals in charge than they ever were before. And if that continues to grow, and it is going to continue to grow, there's going to be a worldwide revolution against them, sun or no sun. And so this whole thing is all happening all at the same time. There's also technologies being formed all over the place. Just talking to Patrick Flanagan about this, of all sorts of technologies being formed where you may be able to power your entire household from a machine the size of a shoebox. It's self-powered. So perhaps all the grid and everything in 5 or 10 years will be, not even a concern.
Well, it's an interesting point. Barbara, I wanted to ask you as well how you think that the sun and the changes in the sun actually is affecting consciousness and maybe be the catalyst behind some of the changes that needs to happen in the way we think about things, we think about problems, and maybe, again, the development of a different kind of technology.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've got a great story for you. Let's go to March 1989. Which was one of the big solar events, major solar flares. And this story is a really good example of how this game is much more complicated and subtle it could give us much more trust maybe than we realize. We had all these big solar flares in March 1989. And at that time, we have a global group of ceremonial teachers, and we go to various ceremonial sites at key moments, key crisis points, in order to do some work. So I got a call in late 1988 from Humbox Men, who's one of my elders, Mayan elders down in Mexico. And Humbox called together a huge ceremonial, 3-week ceremonial event that started right around March 11th, and it went through the spring equinox, 1989 and into early April. And the goal here was to go to all of the major Mayan ceremonial sites and do certain key ceremonies in order to awaken not just the planet and not just our consciousness, but also we were working with awakening the sun. And so what happened on that journey is I flew down there and got to the Mexico City airport just when the biggest solar flare hit, and the whole Mexico City airport got knocked out, and I barely was able to make it to the location that I had to go to. And during those ceremonies, there's tremendous consciousness and tremendous energy because of the solar flares. And then when we came to the culmination of the ceremonies at the spring equinox at Chichen Itza, at this point there were 3,000 ceremonial teachers and 50,000 people. This is a very big ceremony. And at the very end of the ceremony, there was a whooshing, sucking, a compression in the air that was so bizarre that we all thought the world was coming to an end. Everybody just simply looked up, and all we could see was movement in the sky. And what was passing over our head was one of the biggest asteroids that's come in the last 100 years or so, asteroid 1989 FC. And so then at that point, the teachers always get together after the work is done and we talk about what's going on. And I looked at Humbots and I said, Humbots, did you know that an asteroid was coming? And were we there because of that asteroid? And he told us that in his family records going back to 1000 AD, the knowledge of this particular asteroid had been cataloged. And we were there in order to prevent this asteroid from actually hitting the planet. And when I went through that experience, and everything I've told you is absolutely true, when I went through that experience, something in me clicked, and I went, I don't really know what's going on here, but I'm just going to have to trust it, that something is positive is happening. So that's kind of where I am with how I respond to things.
All right, very good. We're going to take a break here in a little bit. Before we do that, though, we want to talk about each and every one of you, your websites, so people know where to go to find out more. And please go ahead and mention the titles that you have available as well. Lawrence, why don't we begin with you?
Sure, thank you. My website is lawrenceejoseph.com. My latest book is called Solar Cataclysm, and it's about how the sun has shaped our past and in many ways determines our future.
And you have a new one coming out as well. Tell us about that briefly.
That's the book that just came out.
That's the one that came out. Okay, that's right. And previous to that, we have Apocalypse 2012 and Solar Cataclysm, correct?
We have the first one was Apocalypse 2012. The second one was Aftermath. And then the new one that just came out is Solar Cataclysm. And thank you for allowing me to include them.
Definitely, definitely. Barbara, let's move on to you, and please mention your websites and everything. Are we going to change your website after 2012? Well, then.
No, because it's a fulcrum point. My website is hand, H-A-N-D, clow, C-L-O-W, 2012.com. And I definitely am not going to change it, and it's not going away either. And Awakening the Planetary Mind came out in 2011. late in 2011. And then I'm also the author of Alchemy of Nine Dimensions, which is my major work, and the Pleiadian Agenda and Mayan Code, and so on and so forth. And then next year, or actually early in 2013, a new edition of Liquid Light of Sex is coming out, which people are looking forward to. And then also I'm in the middle of writing a trilogy called The Ruby Crystal.
Ruby Crystal, okay. Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea when that will be out?
I'm working with a publisher right now, and I'm not sure, because it's complicated, because the first book is basically mostly done, but I've got the other two, so I'm in the middle of a lot of negotiations.
All right, very good. Jay, tell us about your websites and the projects you're involved in currently.
Oh, yeah, you can read all my free stuff and my weird articles at jaywidener.com, jaywidener.com, and you can get my videos at sacredmysteries.com. I've got, in the middle of doing a trilogy on Stanley Kubrick. I've got the first two out. The third one will be out in about 6 months. And, I have a feature film coming out, called Shasta, which is all about the lore around Mount Shasta in Northern California, which is actually associated with kind of what we're talking about. So, and that'll be a feature film coming out in the beginning of this year. We're going to be at Sundance and Sedona Film Festival and the Berlin Film Festival and a lot of others. So,
very good. The website's here again, lawrenceejoseph.com, hanklow2012.com, jaywidener.com, and sacredmysteries.com, and of course we're going to have these linked up as well. All right, well, lady and gentlemen, stay with us. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back after this. In the second hour, we discuss if government is necessary to solve problems that seem to be creating more problems than necessary. Barbara talks about the alchemy of the collective mind, and then Lawrence presents research on how radioactive medical waste can predict giant solar flares. It's like the sun is sending us messages. And the sun seems to be involved in changing matter as well. It's now been documented that the rate of decay is speeding up. So what is going on? Jay will talk about the alchemical aspects of the sun and an ancient advanced secret society that has been living amongst us, who also might very well be responsible for the cross at Hende. Barbara will explain how we're in a time of taking back the planet, and later we discuss moving beyond 2012 and closing thoughts as the year is about to come to an end. Please go to redicemembers.com and sign up for a membership to continue to listen to the second hour of our program. We have memberships from 3 months up to 2 years, whatever works for you, and it's only €5 per month, by the way. This is independent radio dedicated to bringing you the most intriguing, important, and interesting research, thoughts, and opinions. In our archives on the members' website, beyond the full radio programs going back to 2006, you can also find TV episodes, webcasts, films, music, and commentaries. Stay with us to hear more. We'll be right back with Hour 2, together with Jay, Barbara, and Lawrence. Thank you for listening.